Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Paul Tolley, and I'm delighted to have Mayor Sam Copeland in the studio with me this morning to have our monthly chat, as we generally do after the council meeting. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Paul.
And I'll start by congratulating you on re-election as Mayor.
Thank you. I wasn't sure in what capacity I'd be turning up today or whether indeed I should.
For a moment or not. For people that don't know, there's a process here. There's a mayoral and a deputy mayoral nomination every 2 years. Some places that I've lived have required that when we vote for council, we also vote for mayor. Other places like Armidale, the election of a mayor for the peers, the other councillor. How does it work in Armidale for people who may be interested in the process?
Well, the majority of councils in New South Wales have a councillor-elected mayor. So the council elects the mayor, not the population. And for all of those councils, the usual council term is 4 years, and midway through, so after 2 years, the mayor and deputy positions come up for re-election. This is a shorter council term because the council elections back in 2021 were delayed due to COVID. So the previous council term was very long. This one's only about 2 years and 8 months. And so we had, and most councils around New England, and probably most councils in New South Wales actually had their mayor and deputy mayor elections the week before, and that will take us through to for 12 months until September the 14th, which is when the next elections
are due. I did wonder about the 2 years, and so you're saying that, because I had assumed that the mayor would be elected for the term of the council, so you're saying that will be the case next time, or are we locked into a 2 year?
The council elections are going to be for a 4 year term, mm-hmm. but the mayor and deputy are every 2 years.
Always every two years. Where in other places, they're often for the same, the deputy and mayor are for the same length of time as council.
Only in those few councils that actually have a direct elected mayor.
All right. Okay. We've cleared that one up. The next one I want to go to is the e-scooters. Now, Is there a license required by the operators of the scooters? Is there an arrangement with council? Is there a financial arrangement? How does this work?
Okay. A lot of myth around there, so let's do a bit of myth-busting, shall we?
Well, I woke up and for 3 days there were three on the pavement in front of my place, and everyone was having to walk around to the nature strip. And I've noticed around town they just get dumped on the pavement. I wondered why they can't be put on the nature strip so that people have, pick the older people, have access to the pavement.
It would be an opportunity for you to be a good citizen there and move them, Paul.
Allowed to touch them? I don't know what the requirements are.
Of course you are. Mm. We all have to be grown-ups in this world. So the scooters are a 12-month trial, and so electric scooters are illegal in New South Wales. We're, I think, the last state that hasn't approved them. So Transport for New South Wales wants to conduct a trial to see what is the best way to use the scooters, and what makes our trial, and Armidale was selected. A number of councils applied to be the host site. Armidale was selected, and I like to think that that's because we're a forward-thinking, smart city.
Well, we have a TAFE and a university, and it may be related to age demographic as well.
Look, it could. Mm-hmm. What makes our trial unique, though, is that our scooters are to be ridden on the road now, as opposed to the footpath. Not as many people know that as they should. Now, it's all laid out on their Beam Mobility app, which is the one that you need to use to get the scooters moving. So they're to be ridden on the road, and you're meant to wear a helmet. There is now a 3 strikes policy because they have geolocators. If you're riding them constantly on the footpath and you're not wearing a helmet, 3 strikes, then you're you're banned from using them, and they can just switch you off electronically to do that. The scooters are also geolocated, or there's a geofence, if you like, that limits where they can go. And so some areas are out of bounds, they'll just won't work there. UNE was within that fence, then they're outside the fence. We're trying to get them back into the fence. If that hasn't happened yet, it will shortly. So you do see a lot of e-scooters just parked up along the Elm Avenue.
Yes, I've seen them.
Yeah, you've seen them there. So there's that. Then just maybe to come to your point for parking, it comes down to common decency. Are people going to park them thoughtfully or not? Now, we see some people, they're, you know, the fools of the world will, you know, put them on a roundabout and think it's funny. This is something where, you know, the council tussled with, but I think it was pretty easy to dismiss. If we have to make decisions based on the stupidest, most selfish people in our region, then we can't have nice things. It's as simple as that. So what we have to do is hope that the idiots sort of run out of enthusiasm for it and there's something else for them to do, or that the good people actually pick up after the fools. Now, the other thing is, the idea of a scooter is to get from A to B, not A to A. So there are about 50 different parking areas dotted around the city, and if you park your scooter back in one of those designated areas, you get a 50 cents off your ride. If you just leave it outside your house, that's fine. You just don't get the 50-cent discount. And the idea is that, yep, park it thoughtfully, let people get around, but not everyone's thoughtful.
Because it did strike me that the company that's operating them, Beam, has a great advantage against many other companies. They are using the public space, the public pavement very often, rather than even than the nature strip, as a free storage area for their product.
Yeah, probably.
So council could perhaps ask them for a fee for storage space.
Oh, we probably could, but let's not quibble.
Right. I'm just pointing it out. I mean, yeah. You're not required to have a road license, a vehicle license of any sort, but you must ride them on the road. And I did notice this because I had an experience in the early days where I approached an intersection where there was a stop sign on either side of me, and I had the right of way, and three of them came through in a group straight through a stop sign diagonally through the intersection, not following the idea of lanes, and I would have cleaned up the final one if I hadn't hit the brakes very sharply, and then I got the usual finger, and I thought, and that's why I wanted to ask you, because I thought, these are on the road, but people using them don't necessarily seem to understand the rules of the road or recognise a stop sign
you
or whatever.
You have to be aged over 16. Mm-hmm. So the rules are you have to be aged over 16, you have to wear a helmet, you have to ride them on the road. They're sort of the bigger picture rules. So there'll be greater enforcement with that. It is a trial. So a few changes that have occurred is that they're all locked down. They won't work between midnight and 4 a.m. on a Friday or a Saturday evening, which, you know, for obvious reasons.
Well, that is protection against idiots.
It is. Sensible people who drift into idiocy. So that's, you know, and that's what the trial will do. But 3 weeks in, I've been really impressed. You know, there was the initial hoo-ha on social media that became quite funny. You know, backlash, this is terrible. It's the end of civilization. The scooters, you know, I've seen them holding people up and, you know, whatever. Then we had the great riposte from people saying, look, stop being such a negative Nelly about this. Let's get on board. And now it's all just gone quiet.
Yes, and I'm not being negative. I'm just asking the questions because one day they weren't there and the next day there was three right in front of my place on the pavement
begging you to
use the situation. I didn't know what they were, to be quite honest. I hadn't seen them anyway.
What is interesting, though, is how the number of people, I think, are riding them on the footpath thinking they're doing the right thing.
Maybe there's a little more communication.
Communication needs to happen. Yes. The other thing I should hasten to add is that, and I think it's probably died down, but, you know, a few of our local conspiracy theorists were thinking the council's getting a kickback. Council hasn't paid any money for this. We're not getting any money back. It's a trial to see if we can have nice things.
No, that's good. There's going to be a draft ecologically sustainable development policy put for public display and public comment.
Public exhibition, yes.
Yeah, could you tell us what it is, please?
Yeah, this is just around our building codes. So the thinking is that if you're building a new house, any new development that you know, has meets certain requirements, either through its you know, might be double glazed, it might be better insulated, it might be be aligned, you know, north facing, and you know, big windows to the north, etc., etc. That meeting a bunch of these criteria would see that the developer fee that you pay for a new build is reduced or waived. So there is an incentive to spend money on a more ecologically sustainable dwelling than something cheap and cheerful.
And that's very interesting. It's always struck me as odd, if you like, that when people, including myself, look to buy a car, a new car, we look at the cost of the vehicle, we look at the various capabilities of the vehicle, and we all look at with a petrol vehicle, the fuel consumption and the cost of maintenance of a vehicle. But when people buy a home, they look at the price. They don't look at the cost of maintenance of the home and the things you're mentioning, insulation, double glazing, a lot of other aspects can give you a considerably cheaper maintenance, yearly maintenance costs on a house. I'm not talking about maintenance and repairs. I'm just talking how much does it cost to maintain and live in that house over a 12-month period. And I think perhaps that's the direction you're going in with this.
It is. And look, personally, I, as someone who lives in a 105-year-old weatherboard house, I know it is a very expensive house to live in an Armidale winter. Mm-hmm. And so, I wish 105 years ago, they'd actually built my house
with
these principles.
Well, mine is 98 years old, and when the first money I spent on the place was not on aesthetics or beautifying it in any way. I spent money on insulation. I spent money on permits. I spent money on all the sorts of things you're talking about, solar hot water and solar electricity, to reduce the annual running cost of my property. And I think we do have a system, of course, in Australia where houses are rated according to sustainability, but we don't see a rating as vehicles have for how much it's going to cost you annually to run.
No, that's a good point. I expect we will get a lot of from the public exhibition period, we will get a lot of input on this.
I think you will too.
And it's great. And look, it's something that, you know, the region itself won't necessarily benefit from, council won't benefit from, but, you know, it's all about doing our bit.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good idea, and I think that the first thing you can do is look at the return on investment cost. So, for example, I looked at solar batteries. Return on investment is too far away, so I passed it away. But when I looked at originally, the return on investment on solar panels was good. So you think, how many years do I need to wait before I'm getting a financial benefit? And that's partly what we're talking about here. And little things like permits, planting deciduous trees on the to the west and the north, so that in winter the leaves give you protection from the sun.
Yes.
And in winter the leaves fall off and you get the sun. There's a lot that can be done, and I think perhaps we need to talk to people a little more about this and think about how much does this house cost for me to run per year as against this other one I'm considering buying.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you'll get a lot of interest. The Future Fund, you pointed to this last month, and you piqued my interest. So we're moving along, aren't we?
We are moving along. Look, it's something we've been working on in the background. There's still more work to be done. But the New England Future Fund made it onto the council agenda this month, and it was really for the councillors to endorse the direction that we're taking with this. So to bring everybody up to speed and give them an opportunity to say, yep, we think that's a good idea, crack on. So we're not sure what the final form of it will look like. But at the last council meeting, we endorsed a benefit-sharing framework, so what we expect from the developers. And that was a minimum of 1.5% of construction costs. So these are the renewable energy developers coming in.
Minimum, these are the wind farm people.
The solar, the pumped hydro. Mm-hmm. A minimum of 1.5%.
Oh, can I quickly say, does that include the transmission line people?
No.
Okay.
The transmission lines will be built by the state government.
Right.
And there'll be a different sort of
arrangement
there.
Yep. Okay.
And so the the benefit sharing framework that we endorsed last month was 1.5% of construction cost. Now, based on what is being proposed in New England, certainly in Armidale anyway, that'll lead to tens of millions of dollars. Now,
is that 1.5% at time of construction or annually?
At time of construction. And so the two, there's one that's we've negotiated that's public, there's one that's been negotiated that hasn't come forward yet, but where they usually end up is probably 50% of that is paid up front and the balance over a 20-year period. So now the idea behind the Future Fund is to build intergenerational benefit and not just squander the sugar hit that will come. So the Future Fund was sort of the concept of it, you know, I'd been thinking about that for quite a while as we were negotiating these agreements. And what many of the developers have historically done when they've gone to other regions is they've been the only show in town. So they've created their own community benefit fund and they've spent it within a 5 or 10K radius of the project, which just isn't going to work here. And I've mentioned that in previous previous chats we've had. So with the Future Fund, we're going to pool all of that money. There will be a board of guardians that are external to council that are overseeing that money, where it is invested, and there are some limits on what those investments can be. So where it is invested, the other thing that the board of guardians will be charged with is not raiding the corpus or the principal and determining where the determining what the annual dividend is going to be. So that's the role of the board of guardians. Then with that annual dividend that comes out, that, you know, could feasibly grow to $2.5 to $3 million a year, that annual dividend, I would say that council will have, it will be able to determine how a significant chunk of that is spent. And then we'll have a community benefit fund or community benefit, sorry, not fund, community panel that will determine where the balance is spent. So why we want council to make the determination for the bulk of it is so that we can invest in big things and big improvements in amenities in our region. So, for example, if we need a new pool complex at Armidale or Gyra, we can go out and borrow the $20 or $30 million that's required to do that and pay that off over a period of time with revenue that comes out of the Future Fund. That's what it should be there for.
So the council have final authority on how money is spent and the independent guardians just take care of legislative and
they take
other
care
requirements.
Of it. Well, let's say council might have a say over where 75% of the money is spent and the remaining 25%, a community group or community panel,
which who are separate from the guardians,
would make a call on the rest. And so I could see, you know, and this will all be worked out in coming months, but I could see the different groups around the region might put in applications for funding. You know, we want to do up the tennis court here, we need a new scout hall, we need, you know, we want solar on the roof at this particular hall out at Wollumbimby, what have you. They could put in applications, and then the community panel would make a decision on who gets what money.
When do you expect this to be up and running?
I think the Future Fund will be up and running, or the structure will be in place within 6 months.
Right. And then we wait for the developer.
Then we wait for the developers' money to come in. Mm. So that'll be sort of trickling in. You know, probably start within 12 months, and for the next 10 or 15 years. Mm. Actually, for the next 30 years, actually.
Yes, as long as it's in place. A couple of interesting things with regard to the airport, and I noticed that in the press release for the re-election of both you and your deputy, you said that we need quality recreation for all of us and unique experiences to draw in tourists. It appears as though Rex is going again. They have come and gone in the past. And for some time we've had the cafe at the airport not operating. So I guess this goes to the tourist experience as well as to the local experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so there's both good news and bad news around the airport. Well, let's deal with the bad news first, and that is Rex withdrawing. They notified us on Thursday evening that they'd be putting out an announcement on Friday that, yeah, they were withdrawing from Armidale, suspending their services from Armidale from the end of October this year until the end of March next year, and they cited a lack of pilots. In fact, they were quite aggressive. They cited Qantas poaching their pilots.
Yeah, I saw it. And this is happening in other centres, not just Armidale.
No, that's right. So a shortage of pilots to fly the Saabs, and they also cited a shortage of, you know, engines and parts, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, their coda to it was, well, you know, we'll be back at the end of March, provided the situation changes.
And supply lines improve for staff and equipment.
And so, you know, all we can really do is take them at their word.
After you've just spent the money on the gate.
Yes. Well, we did the cheap. We did the discount option.
Yes.
Which is good. So it really only cost us probably about $50,000 to, you know, open a gate and let people walk out. That said, Link still use that gate, so it hasn't been lost. But yes, we did spend some money to accommodate Rex there. That said, they put money towards it as well.
And now the other one is the cafe. And
yes, the good news.
I remember when the cafe didn't operate for many years, and I'm going back probably between 2005-2010, and the people, various applicants who were keen to run it, all made the point together that the rent was such that it wasn't the council's required rent was such that it wasn't financially viable. And I'm of the view that 80% of something's worth more than 100% of nothing. So if you put your rent at a level where nobody will take it, you've got 100% of nothing. If you lower your rent a little bit, maybe you get 80% of something. So is this still an issue, or have we...
No, that's not the issue at all, because
there's this... It was the issue at the time.
Yes, I can't speak for other previous councils.
And COVID was a problem, wasn't it, in terms of people going through?
I think COVID was the final nail in the coffin. No, we've been very generous with rent-free periods for this. And yes, we did have a tenant that was going to go in, then they withdrew, and then the other potential tenant that bid decided not to pursue it as well. We have the alternate route going in.
From Urala?
From Urala. I'm a regular there. I think they do a fantastic job.
It's my place of choice in Urala.
It is. It's terrific. So I'm sure that if they can bring some of that, you know, genuine alternate route experience to the airport, we're all going to be much better off.
So when do we expect to see that operating? Do we have any sense of time?
I'm sure we do. I just don't know. It is within coming weeks. So that's
now
great.
Signage on the way into Armidale has been an issue for many, many years. There was the much maligned People Thrive, the Thrive campaign, and nobody in Armidale seemed to know what that meant. I certainly didn't. And
I think there was Foodies Thrive when we first moved here 10 years ago.
Other people thrive, but I had visitors who asked me what it meant, and I had to say, look, I've got no idea. The other thing about the council signage coming into Armidale, and if you're in a vehicle and you're travelling and you've got your eye on the road, you don't get very much, and I'm talking about the current signs as well, you don't get very much time, a fraction of a second, to register signs. And the signs that Armidale Council has put up have traditionally been so busy that you really, I'm speaking from a practical point of view, you don't really get much time to register what's there. And I think they have a lot of pretty colours and things around them, but nobody's really thought about the fact that you've maybe got a half a second to register that while you're driving and keeping your eyes on the road. So I'm going to make a practical comment about that. But the other thing that's going on is that Councillor Widders had put up a proposal that a sign should say, "Welcome to the ancestral home of the Anawan people." Did that go through last night?
Yeah, that went through unanimously. So in terms of signage, that's what it's really about. So it's acknowledging the traditional owners. And Armidale has always, I think, for a long time, has stood out as not having anything there. Drove down to Orange and going through Dubbo, welcome to Wiradjuri country, welcome to Gomeroi, all of those things, you see them. And I think it reflected rather poorly on us. I know previous councils had attempted to do this, and there's, you know, the Armidale, New England anyway, but certainly within the Armidale LGA, there are a number of different mobs, and there are, you know, in addition to the Annawan, there's another group that are in a way laying claim to Armidale. And so there's a little bit of history in this particular motion, in that back in June this year, Councillor Widders put up a motion to have signs on the LGA boundaries and acknowledging, I think, four different mobs. And that one didn't get through because it specifically excluded a particular mob. So that didn't get through, but Council undertook to hold consultations on what would work, to meet with other groups, etc., etc. And this is where we've landed. So it's important to understand that the signs that were actually didn't go through unanimously. One councillor abstained and one councillor was absent. So it went through 9-1, and an abstention is counted as a no. And so what these signs will be, they'll be just placed on the Armidale city limits, acknowledging Armidale City as sitting on Annawan land. And the design for it will be, you know, referenced back to our Aboriginal Advisory Committee, who will determine what the sign looks like, etc. But it's important to understand that this is the first of many. I think we will now consult more widely, and if I were a betting man, I think we will end up with signs on the LGA boundaries acknowledging all the different mobs that whose lands the Armidale LGA sits on.
And going back to my first point, I hopefully, and it's not your responsibility, but hopefully there's a simplicity so that these things can be seen. I mean, and I have a bit of background, as you know, with advertising and such, and people that do outdoor advertising know this very well. They know that you can't put too much on a signpost because people just miss it all.
Yes.
So, hopefully
we will. Well, as I said, we'll be, my understanding is it'll go to the Aboriginal Advisory Committee to do that.
Just as a side comment, I would love to see less of the corporate speak in a lot of councils' releases. The comment in from the agenda on the public exhibition of draft ecologically sustainable development used incentives once, incentivized twice, and this word kept cropping up. And incentivize used to mean encourage.
Yes.
So encourage and incentivize. But I've just noticed that there's someone who obviously is grabbing all the American corporate speak and throwing it in wherever they can. Maybe I'm old, just a bit off-putting, but I saw some of the language there and I found it a bit strange. We're getting near the end. I did want to ask you, and we've talked about it a few times, but in your media release it says, we've shored up our water security with the acquisition of Oakey Dam and the work on raising Malpass Dam wall. We're getting to a point where water levels are going to fall sufficiently that work can be done on Malpass Dam?
You'd think.
You'd hope.
Look, no, I'd rather water levels didn't fall. Actually, on that, it's a good point. I'm getting asked a lot by, when are we going to go to water restrictions? Because it is dry.
Yes,
I flew in yesterday morning, and really, once you get this side of Yooralla, just looking down from the plane, it really is crisp here. The current policy is that when Malpass hits 80% capacity, we go to level one water restrictions. Malpass is currently at 99.3% capacity and filling through spring. So I think we will have to revisit. I mean, personally, maybe we should go to level one when Malpass hits 90, for example. But it's a little bit of a paradox. So Malpass is still filling up, but we've got a lot of
grazing. That's
grazies.
Not from the sky.
That's not from the sky. That's from the ground.
Spring systems.
Yeah. But we've got a lot of graziers now who are carting stock water, or even those that have water tanks attached to their houses are having to fill up from the town water. So, yeah, it's strange times we're in. I think it would probably be a pretty good signal if full council to start to introduce at least some level one water restrictions soonish. But they're conversations that we're having internally.
And Malpass Dam is raising is still going to go ahead?
Yes, of course. It'll still go ahead. So the engineering works and the tendering documents, which I think was going to be a 12-month process, is still happening. So once that's done and we know exactly how much it's going to cost or what we need to be asking for, we'll be out treading the pavements of Macquarie Street to get the funding.
And I may be wrong here, but it was suggested to me, and I'm not an expert or a person who an engineer, but it was suggested to me that the one silver lining, if water levels go down sufficiently, is that it may make storage retention walls and whatever easier to install.
Look, it could, and in any event...
And that this was an opportunity to be grabbed, basically, was the comment.
Yes, yeah. Look, the... If Malpass has to be lowered to 50% capacity for work to begin, what would be a terrible look is if we're in the depths of a hard drought and Malpass is at, say, 70%, but we just have to release water. Anyway, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
You've made hard decisions in the past with the rate rises, and I'm sure, sure you're up for that again. Look, I think we've covered it. We'll talk again in a month. Thank you very much,
Thanks, Paul,
for coming in and explaining a lot of these issues to people who don't get their hands or don't have the time to look at the agenda items and everything else. But I think it's good that we backfill a lot of these ideas and let people know what's going on, and that they should keep an eye out for the draft Ecologically Sustainable Development Public Exhibition if they want to make comment.
Indeed. Terrific. Thanks very much, Paul.
Thanks very much. All the best.